Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where we discuss all things related to Greco-Roman civilization. Join us for a crazy discussion of the history, philosophy, poetry, and art of the ancient world, as well as the classics' afterlife through the Renaissance and down to today. And now, here's our hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Welcome, listeners. I'm David Noe here with my co-host, Dr. Jeff Winkle. How are you today, Jeff?
I am doing great, David. How are you?
I'm real well, thanks. So we're glad you've all tuned in for the inaugural podcast of Ad Nauseam. Why don't we share with our listeners, Jeff, what that title means and why we chose it?
Well, we tossed around a few ideas, I think, but we settled on this, I think, for two main reasons. I think, one, it's Latinate.
Right.
And that speaks to kind of the broader topics that we're going to be covering on this podcast. But it's also, it's lighter. It's kind of self-deprecating. Ad nauseum means like to the point of vomiting.
Yes. Right? So you've taken in all you can and you can't take in any more.
Right. Exactly. And then it comes out. I don't think I'm wrong in saying that when you see things written in Latin or when something in Latin shows up, say, in a movie,
right.
Often the intention is to kind of raise the seriousness level. Something in Latin immediately has kind of an aura of importance.
Definitely. Right? In fact, pretty much not a week goes by that I don't receive some kind of communication from someone asking, it happened yesterday, how do I say this in Latin?
Really? You get a lot of those.
I get a lot of those.
Wow.
Because I want it to sound more important, more impressive, grandiloquent, if you will.
Right, right. You want it on a seal or a motto, right?
That's right.
Right.
Or maybe a tattoo. I get that also.
I remember in grad school getting those kind of requests as well. It being Latin suggests we're going to be dealing with serious stuff.
Right, things that are grave.
Right, exactly. But also the fact that it's to the point of nausea, to the point of vomiting, also reflects that we're going to be less serious from time to time as
right.
well. It's going to be a mix of those kinds of things. So I think that title really gets at the two sides of that.
Mm-hmm. So for this episode, we're going to talk about classics as a way of life.
That's right.
But before we get into that, let's take a little bit of time to just introduce ourselves. We're going to devote a later episode to a little more autobiographical
right.
elements. But Jeff, tell us a little bit about yourself as we get started here.
Yes. So as David said, my name is Jeff Winkle, and I am currently a humanities professor at Grand Rapids Community College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. But my academic training and background is in the classics. And so I was a classics major, classical languages and history major in college. After college, I went on to do a PhD in classics at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. And classics has been a lifelong interest of mine from the time I was a kid and from the books that my mom and dad handed me. In talking about classics as a way of life, it really got me thinking about how classics has informed my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just an interest that I came into in college or even in high school. It's something that is kind of threaded from my childhood up to the present day.
Right.
It never gets dull.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, David, introduce yourself to the audience.
Right. So, similarly, Jeff, I got interested in classics late high school, early college. I had never taken a Latin course until I got to my undergrad. We have the same alma mater. Used to be Calvin College, now Calvin University
That's
here
right.
in Grand Rapids. And then I began taking some Latin courses, taking some Greek courses, went on from Calvin to the University of Iowa, and have been teaching classics professionally ever since. Going on, actually, just completed my 20th year now
wow.
of teaching classics professionally.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think about my own career. I think going back to when I was teaching in grad school, it's almost close to 25.
Yeah,
for me as well. So
right.
a long time in the profession for both of us.
Definitely, and learned a lot over the years. I would say I remember my first Latin class that I was teaching, one of the first at the University of Iowa, and I was only a couple semesters ahead of my students in terms of the amount of Latin that I had.
I remember that as well. Yeah.
And I was very close in age.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It's crazy. This is maybe something we can talk about on a future episode as well, is about how we share this this idea that you never feel like you fully learn something or you begin to master it until you start teaching it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a Latin phrase for that, I think. In fact, it goes something like discitur docendo, which
yes.
means one learns by teaching, in the
yeah.
process of teaching. So we talked about the name,
yes.
Ad Nauseam, why the name, and we're going to cover a wide range of classical topics, and we'll talk more about that in a moment, but stretching basically from the Minoans and the Mycenaeans, the precursors of the Greeks, and try to move all the way down through the present, given our own areas of interest and expertise.
So we're talking 4,000 years of history?
Yes, and of course, we're not going to cover each one of those.
We're not going to go year by year.
No.
No.
Nor are we going to cover each era with similar proficiency or expertise.
Of course.
Because we have specialties, yours being Apuleius.
Apuleius.
Yep, yeah. The late antique Roman author. What were his, what's his approximate century?
Second century, mid 150s.
Prose author, right? He wrote the Metamorphoses?
Yes, and along with another number of Middle Platonic treatises.
Okay.
Yes. And your expertise is in Cicero.
In Cicero, yep. So as a graduate student, I had to choose an author, a special author in each of the languages, much as you did, I'm sure.
Right.
And so for Greek, I chose Plato. Hmm. And for Latin, I chose Cicero.
Heavy.
Yeah, heavy stuff.
Heavy
definitely.
Stuff. Yeah.
So I got to read Cicero's three main philosophical dialogues and a number of other things as well. And this is a nice segue.
Yeah, speaking of Cicero.
Yeah, speaking of Cicero, into our topic for today, which is classic as a way of life. Now, Cicero has this expression, philosophia est ars vitae, which means philosophy is the art of life or the best way to live. So we're going to try to introduce a variation on that and say not philosophy narrowly conceived, but life in the pursuit of literature, poetry, things that are aesthetically pleasing, beautiful, nourishing to the soul. We want to suggest that these are the way that one ought to live, one ought to spend their leisure time. So Jeff, as we get into this topic a little bit, we have this excerpt from Cicero's Pro Archia.
Yes.
A speech that he wrote in 62 BC. So the pro speeches are all in defense of someone. So Cicero wrote the pro speeches in defense, the in speeches like in Catilinam, the speeches where he was the prosecutor. But in the Pro Archia, section 16, in defense of the poet, the Greek poet Aulus Licinius Archius, he has this to say. So I'm going to tee up a little Latin for us here.
All right.
Quod si non his tantus fructus ostender retur, et si ex his studiis delectatio sola peteretur. So the key phrase that we have there is delectatio sola, simply pleasure or pleasure alone. So let's use that as a jumping off point for this discussion of classics as a way of life.
Yeah.
If nothing from these studies, if nothing, no other kind of enjoyment were sought, if only pleasure were sought from these studies, and then Cicero goes on to say, it would be the most humane and the most free-spirited or generous kind of diversion for the human soul. So maybe you can say a few things, Jeff, about how you see classics, rather than philosophy, classics as a way of life.
Yeah, when I think about this is... And I try to talk about this to my students as well. You know, students come into, say, a mythology class, and for obvious and good reasons, they say, this is going to be fun.
Right.
But maybe in the back of their mind, they're thinking, this is not practical.
Right.
This is going to maybe kind of a nice diversion from the nursing degree that I'm working on.
Yeah, or computer science or engineering or something like that.
And so I think that maybe students wouldn't put it that way explicitly, that they would say, well, I'm going to enjoy this for 4 months and then I'm going to set it aside. But maybe that's kind of the attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I try to impress upon them is, it really takes me back to something, a phrase I got from you was that being invested in the classics and seeing the classics as a way of life means never being bored.
Right.
You have your working life. You have your leisure time. And I would make the larger argument that classes as a way of life would inform both of those.
Right.
But this idea of when you're not working, when you're not sleeping, what's driving? What are you interested in? What do you consider to be beautiful? What do you consider to be meaningful? That's where I find particularly kind of the classics really coming into kind of organizing and fleshing out and describing the things that I enjoy.
Right.
So, like for me, it was like in my introduction, I was talking about this going back to when I was a kid, and my gateway into the classics was mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And mythology, it's one of those things that, despite kind of there's kind of a nerd quality to it.
Yeah, and this was even before the days of Rick Riordan and those immensely popular Half-Blood Prince and all those novels that he wrote.
Sure. Right. But smack dab in the middle of Hollywood era, where mythology it's kind of come and gone in waves, but it's never fully gone away.
No.
Those cheesy kind of sword and sandal Hercules movies.
Yeah, and the Hercules Disney movie was after we were out of high school, but very, very popular.
Very, very popular, right.
And you have the old Spartacus movies, the sword and sandal, like you said, Ben-Hur and all of that. Gladiator.
Gladiator, right.
In 2000 or 99, right. Something like that.
So Troy. There was the Alexander movie that kind of that some Oliver people thought Stone. Was going to put the nail in the coffin of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it didn't succeed, though.
Didn't succeed, but professional storytellers, for better and for worse,
right,
keep going back to that well.
Yep.
And so if mythology has always struck me as an interesting thing, that there's kind of a nerdy quality to it. It's kind of the Dungeons and Dragons, but it's also something that's always been cool.
Mm-hmm.
That those legends have never gone away, and they bring different worlds together. And for me, it was the narratives that it was the Greek myths that led me to Tolkien, to Narnia,
right?
And really kind of seeing as I got older and seeing the kind of the lighter and the more serious sides of those stories, of seeing kind of how Homer, the Greek legends, is really the glue that holds all of that together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. What about you? What would you say?
Well, it's similar for me, except I kind of went at it a different way, you might say, because I didn't really know about the existence of a lot of these stories. One of my earliest memories of studying the classics was actually a Sesame Street book.
Sesame Street.
And this was the adventures of Bert and Ernie, but I believe Bert was dressed as Penelope, and it was a retelling of the Odyssey with Bert dressed as Penelope. But of course, in my childhood ignorance, I didn't even know how to pronounce the word. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have had this experience. If they do a lot of reading, they are exposed to a lot of words that aren't pronounced in everyday speech.
Sure.
So I thought that the individual's name was Penelope.
Right.
I didn't know that she was called Penelope. Similar to when I was in graduate school and I was teaching, and I described some passage of literature as Macabre. And one of my students actually corrected me and said, Mr. Noe, I think that's pronounced macabre. And I said, you've got to be kidding. What's that R doing in there? It's clearly macabre.
Right.
And so I failed that student, obviously.
And yeah. And this is compounded by the fact that even amongst people in the field, you'll find different pronunciations,
sure,
of Greek names. You know, Telemachus, Telemachus.
Yes, that's true.
Right. Socrates. Yeah.
And lots of different spellings as well.
Exactly. Right.
But there's no excuse for macabre. That's just, that one's on me, as they say.
Right, it's clearly haunted you all these years.
It has haunted me, yeah. So I didn't really have much exposure to the classics early. And so this notion of developing classics as a way of life, this has come slowly over time.
Yeah.
Certainly I was enchanted very early with the notion of the life of the mind, right? I knew that even though I might have to make a living doing something that didn't involve intellectual work, I knew that the life of the mind was very enchanting to me.
Yeah.
I read a lot as a kid, whatever kind of literature I could find. A lot of it was not especially high literature in any sense. I just didn't have that exposure. But as an undergraduate, then I began to be exposed to the works of Herodotus, Plato, obviously, Cicero, Virgil. And these things began to enchant my imagination. And I had a sense of homecoming. These were the stories. This was the sense of imaginative literature, the worlds that were created. Now, these things were enchanting to
me. Nostos.
Yes.
Yes, a return.
That's right.
Yeah.
So Jeff's making a reference here to the Nostoi. These were the individuals after the Trojan War who had to make their way home. And of course, the most famous is Odysseus. So I had my own homecoming, you might say, to the world of classics. But even then on through grad school, I never had the impression, I guess we're getting into autobiography here a little bit, but
unavoidable. Yeah.
I never had the impression that I could make a living teaching classics. I thought, well, I will pursue these interests as long as I can,
yeah,
and as long as I can do so affordably, but maybe I'll just end up, selling insurance or something. You know, not an ignoble profession, something that pays the bills, it's
right,
decent, it's worthwhile. I didn't think I could make classics a way of life. But even for those who don't teach classics professionally, there is, I would suggest, a tremendous amount of pleasure to be derived from the study of literature.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you were saying how you talk to your students who are on their way to a career in nursing or engineering. You talk to them about how they're going to spend their free time. My students know I have a similar sort of approach. I always say, when you come home from your six-figure computer science job, when you come home from your engineering, your nursing, whatever it may be, chemistry job, how are you going to fill all of your free time?
Right.
And I suggest to them that although consuming pop culture, has value, and I do that myself, like the movies and the shows and the music and such, I would suggest that a diet of only those things is not going to help you engage, and here we might disagree a little bit, Jeff, is not going to help you engage deeply in some of the perennial questions.
No, I think by and large, I think I'd agree with that. A line that I use in my classes, so I teach at a community college where, the vast majority of my students are very practically minded, right? They are not coming in, by and large, thinking, I want to, dive into the deep end of the life of the mind.
Right.
And so I feel like I have to kind of amp up the way I sell these kinds of things. But a line that I often use is that we live in such a visual culture. Mm-hmm. We live in such where, you know, movies, videos are at the fingertips of everybody.
Right.
With a glowing brick in your pocket.
Right.
I say that one of the real uses of kind of studying classics or mythological narrative and kind of understanding how story works is that it allows you to read the culture rather than the culture read you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so rather than just kind of let the popular culture from the ridiculous to the sublime just kind of wash over you
mm-hmm.
to kill the time,
right.
It really puts you in the driver's seat. You kind of understand how these narratives work. You understand why the characters perhaps are doing what they're doing, what the filmmaker, what the author is up to. It really, not to turn every movie viewing experience into kind of a brain bending academic right. exercise, but it really helps you to kind of to be in control of what's coming into your eyes.
So not every movie has to be followed by a list of discussion questions or something like that.
No, as ideal as that would be, right?
Really, you think so?
No, not at all. Of course not. Of course not.
So I have a very escapist view of consuming film.
Okay.
Right? And again, here we probably differ. We've talked about this before. In fact, I think that we talked about it in Rome once.
We did.
Because one of our students, I don't remember that student's name, but he was talking about film. He was talking about some American epic. And I was trying to argue, as is my wont, that genre is really important. And so you can't call film an epic because an epic requires a certain literary form. It requires poetry in particular. And I think you said something along the lines of, well, within the parameters of film, some have a better claim than others to having epic elements.
Yeah. So. If indeed that's what I said, I'd stand by that.
Yeah. Sure.
We get so loose with our language, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably out of fashion now, but even describing like an experience of, oh, that was epic,
yeah,
right? It just becomes kind of a stand-in for that was huge or had a huge
right.
impact.
Even if there was no actually, if there were no actual poetry involved, right?
Right, right. Right.
It could still be epic.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
Going back to the point, even if the film isn't followed by a list of discussion questions and it's more of an escapist idea of we're just going to spend a few hours checking out and getting our eyes visually feasted,
right.
You would say that you encourage your students to read the culture rather than to have the culture read them.
Yes.
Can you give me an example of how that works?
Well, to give an example from a myth class, a film I love to show is the Coen Brothers' O Brother, Where Art Thou? To the audience, if you haven't seen it, I think it's a great film, and I think it stands on its own whether you know anything about Homer or not. So the conceit of the film is that it's a film that takes place in the American South.
In the Depression era.
Depression era, 1930s. Right. Stars George Clooney in the Ulysses/Odysseus role. And it's a... albeit loose, retelling of the Odyssey in a very, very different medium, chronology, time and place. And so it's one of these films that you could watch it without knowing anything about Homer and love it and say, that's a great film. I enjoyed that. It would be one I'd recommend
mm-hmm.
To my friends. But to watch the film having read the Odyssey and having studied the Odyssey, it goes up to 11
mm-hmm.
To use a Spinal Tap
sure,
reference.
Sure. I think we can trust our audience to get all the Spinal Tap references.
I would hope so. There's in the Venn diagram
yeah.
of kind of classics interest and Spinal Tap, there's an overlap.
There's a heavy overlap.
I mean, that's a very, very specific example.
Mm-hmm.
But to know Homer's Odyssey well
mm-hmm.
and to watch that film, it raises the experience of appreciating and interpreting that film.
Well, we will probably devote an entire episode to O Brother, Where Art Thou?
I hope so.
But
yeah.
one particular item that sticks out from that film is John Goodman cast as the character of Polyphemus.
Yes.
Right? The
Big Dan.
Yes, Big Dan, the cannibalistic savage who dwells in a cave as a cyclops away from, I think this is Odyssey Book 9, if memory serves,
yes,
dwells away from civilization. So in O Brother, Where Art Thou? Big Dan, the Polyphemus character, is a Bible salesman.
Yes. And he has all the airs of a very civilized Southern gentleman.
Yes, he does,
yes.
Right? He wears seersucker and so forth,
exactly.
A white suit. And,
that's right.
But it turns out that beneath the lovely facade,
mm-hmm.
he's actually a monster.
A savage.
Yeah.
And which is a wonderful flip and inversion.
Mm-hmm.
And where, you know, Big Dan, when we first meet him, he's in the fine restaurant in town.
Right.
But where he reveals his true nature is when they actually go to nature. At the tree.
That's right.
And so he takes him out into the quote-unquote wilderness.
And that's right.
And that's where he snaps off the branch and shows the boys who he really is.
Right. Yeah. We don't want to introduce any spoilers for those who haven't seen the film.
Exactly.
Yeah. So going back to Cicero for a moment, if we carry on with part of that quote.
Please do.
Yeah, he says, nam caeterae neque temperum sunt neque aetatem omnium neque locorum, which roughly translated means, he says, Cicero says, this is Pro Archaea 16, other kinds of pursuits do not belong to all times, they do not belong to all ages, and they do not belong to all locations or places. So think of something like athletics, think of something like painting, think of something along those lines. Cicero's claim is that other kinds of human activities are not universal in application. But he'll say, haec studia adolescentiam alunt, these studies, that is the pursuit of literature in particular. Now, the concept of literature in antiquity is much broader than it is today, because literature in antiquity includes philosophy, it includes poetry, it includes tragedy.
It's almost a term for we would say the humanities.
The humanities, yes, the liberal arts. That's right. He says these are of the broadest application, and then he will go on to give a number of examples. But one of the things that I really enjoy about classics is, as I think ahead to the rest of my life, I really look forward to being able to read these works of perennial interest when I'm an old man, if I make it that far.
Right, right.
Cicero tells the story also of the famous Greek tragedian Sophocles, the second of the big three.
Yeah.
And according to legend, Sophocles wrote his Oedipus at Colonus. He wrote his Oedipus at Colonus when he was in his early 90s.
Right.
The idea being that classics is something that applies at all ages and times.
Right, right. I just a note, we'll put the quote that David is reading and translating up on our website, which we'll talk about at the end of the
Put episode. That in the show notes, I
think. In the show notes, yes.
Right, is the podcasting expression.
Right. So if you're interested and want to go to that level, you can read along.
You can drill down.
You can follow the bouncing ball.
That's right. So these studies, this literature, they nourish you when you're young, adolescentiam. They make old age bearable. They make good times better, right? They decorate good times. They provide a refuge and a comfort in hard times.
Yeah.
Delectant domi non impediunt foris. They help you when you're at home. They don't trip you up when you're out in public.
Yeah, I love that. This is exactly what I think is the heart of what arsuetai means, even though he doesn't use that phrase here.
Probably the most famous excerpt from the Pro Archaea is this little bit on literature.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fabulous. The bit about these studies, they nourish your childhood, and they delight your old age. I mean, that really makes me think, take it back to myth. I think about the stories that I gravitated towards when I was a kid, like the stories of Heracles, Hercules, and Odysseus.
Did you have a favorite?
I've always loved the Odyssey.
Yeah.
My views of Odysseus and my views of Heracles have really changed. I think when I was a kid, I wanted to be Odysseus.
Okay.
And I wanted to, slay the monster and be crafty and tricky. And
right.
I love the emphasis on how he used his mind.
Right. Polutropos, right?
Polutropos, exactly.
Is the adjective right at the beginning of the Odyssey. The man who's versatile, skilled in all ways of contending, I think, is one of the translations.
Right. And also literally tossed about.
Yeah.
Right? The man of many turns.
Mm-hmm.
As I get older and as I teach these stories, I kind of moved away from kind of that wish fulfillment interpretation and towards a more seeing them as kind of cautionary tales. Mm. So a lot of these myths are talking about, don't be like this guy.
So don't leave home for almost 20 years.
Right.
Right. Don't abandon your wife and child.
Right. Yeah.
When you come back, right, don't kill all the suitors.
Well, we can get into we should. I would love to do an episode on the Odyssey and maybe
definitely
the end of the Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
Or even things like if Aeolus gives you a bag full of all the ill winds,
right,
maybe tell your crew about it.
Yeah.
Maybe mention what's in this bag and say, hey, guys, don't open this.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I get older, I see less, Odysseus, less as kind of a Saturday morning cartoon, cardboard cutout hero, and much more kind of a very complex and maddening human being.
Right.
And so I think that the story of Odysseus can thrill a six-year-old kid, but can also call an old man to think about what does it mean to be human.
Of course, because great art has the broadest appeal.
Exactly.
Right?
Right.
Great art appeals to the broadest cross-section of humanity.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is reflective maybe of the ancient concept that the Iliad was written by Homer, whether he's the author or not, but the Iliad is written by Homer as a young man, so it's filled with passion.
Hmm.
And the Odyssey was written by Homer as a middle-aged or even old man, so it's primarily about character.
Interesting, yes.
The amazing lessons that I learned from one of my grad school professors, Dr. Jack Holtzmark, was that the Odyssey features weeping and eating every 20 lines or so.
That's right.
Every 20 lines, someone is crying or they're eating.
When you first see Odysseus in real time in that
epic,
right. he's crying on the beach.
That's right.
Yeah.
As a captive of Calypso.
Yes.
So it's a very domestic epic. So like you said, it has that Saturday morning cartoon swashbuckling element to it.
At least in books 9 through 12.
Absolutely.
Right?
Most often excerpted. These thrill children, but even as you age, you find something really incredible about it, because Odysseus is the captive of a number of beautiful women, Calypso, Circe. And yet he says, yeah, you are an immortal goddess, he says to Calypso, and you're more beautiful than my wife, he says, but I'm going home.
Yeah.
Because that's where I belong. And that's where I want to be. I want to see Telemachus. I want to see my son. And I want to see Penelope.
My
right. wife.
That's right.
Yeah.
An episode on Penelope would be...
Definitely
in order. Right?
Yes.
Amazing. Amazing character.
Certainly Odysseus's match in cleverness.
Yes.
Strength of character. We'll have to get into some of the things that Werner Jaeger says about that in his work, Paideia, about Greek culture.
Hmm.
He has some really interesting, controversial things to say about how Homer characterizes the heroic man, the man who has arete, as opposed to the heroic woman, what makes the arete of a woman.
Yeah.
Well, as we wrap this up, Jeff, let's talk a little bit about where we're headed next.
Sure.
What are some of the topics that we're going to be covering in the future?
I think if I can speak selfishly, I would love to do topics that are in line with my own interest in research right now. Ancient religion, an episode on the mystery cults, Eleusis, ancient prose, narratives, folklore, legends.
Yeah, can you discuss... I know we're going to have an episode on bridginess, right?
Yes.
Which is one of your specialties.
Yes.
This concept
I'm feeling
of...
a little bridgy right now.
This concept of gephurismos,
right.
Yeah, the Greeks had a special term for the way that you feel or behave.
Kind of in the in-between.
When you're at a bridge.
At a bridge. Where
you're crossing from one point to the next.
Exactly. So a bridge is both, it's neither side A or B
right.
of the river.
Mm-hmm.
It's both and it's neither.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's unbounded.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the Greeks weren't the only one. You find this kind of uncanniness around the globe in kind of traditional ways of kind of organizing and thinking about space.
Right.
I find that endlessly fascinating.
Yeah.
And so, we'll be talking about bridginess.
Right.
Yeah.
And as well as, you want to say a brief word about the Mithraeum that we visited there at Ostia Antica?
Sure.
Maybe some of our listeners have had the opportunity to travel to Italy and to visit the ancient port of Ostia.
Ostia, right. So it doesn't get the press that Pompeii gets, but it's nearly equally as fascinating. Very well-preserved ancient Roman city. There are a number of these Mithraea in Ostia, these houses of worship and ritual for the god Mithras.
Who was a Persian or Egyptian?
Well, that was what we can talk about that.
Okay.
There was a long-standing academic argument that the Romans inherited this hero god Mithras from the Persians.
Right.
That's kind of out of fashion, that argument.
Okay.
Now, and they see it was more kind of, it was a Roman creation, and they kind of imbued it with the trappings of the East to kind of give it a kind of an exotic flair.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it was actually taken from the Persians.
Right.
But
in the back corner of this massive archaeological
yes.
site.
There is, there's a number of these Mithraea, but the one we went to is you walk down this slope and you enter into this arched underground chamber.
It's kind of crypt. Long and,
yeah, how we'd say that maybe like, I don't know, 50
25,
yards
long? 30 feet.
30 feet? Not,
yeah, maybe, not quite 50 yards.
50 yards. And it's it's an aisle with benches on either side. And at the far end, at the end of the chamber, there is a statue representation of Mithras slaying the bull.
Right.
Which seems to be the central myth in that cult.
Yes. With an oculus, right? A hole, a light opening from above.
From above, right.
Right.
So the whole city's above this chamber.
And then the light shines down on this statue of this young man with
yes.
his Phrygian cap.
It's very right? Indiana Jonesy.
Yep. And
yes.
he is driving a knife into the neck of this bull.
Right. A story that, I mean, there's no written narrative of that story that survives. We still don't fully understand what it means.
Right.
But we know that this secret ritual for this cult that was exclusively masculine.
And very popular in the Roman army.
Very popular in the Roman army. Yes, the soldier class was drawn to to Mithras. Walter Burkert, the famous scholar of ancient religion, is credited with a phrase, if the Roman Empire had not become Christian, it would have become Mithraic, which is ridiculous because of that, you're still talking about half the population.
But he's captured something significant about the popularity, right?
Exactly. And that, I think that was kind of the purpose of the cult. Hyperbole of that. Right. And so it was extremely popular in the first three centuries of this era. And so, yes, I believe this is about 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think it was 2016.
16.
Yep, January of 16.
David and I were there with a large group of students, close to 40 students.
Close to 40.
And we marched up and over the hill. It wasn't part of the kind of the guided...
No, because most tourists, you know, God bless them, not especially interested in that particular element of Roman culture.
Right, which I don't understand, but...
Well...
Such it is.
Yeah.
Right. So we went down into there. We kind of packed the whole group onto those benches. I think we had a student who was... Did a student give a...
Giving a
presentation?
Report. Yes. Yeah, if that student's listening, we don't remember your name. But the crypt has enough room just to fit all of our students, half on each side. There are cobwebs. There's a little water running there.
Yeah.
You know, thankfully, Italy in January is pretty balmy, pretty comfortable. Lined them all up in there and then talked about the cult of Mithras.
Right. And for me, it was one of those kind of hair on the back of your neck, standing up experiences. There's something about the power of place and being there and thinking about the things that may have happened there. So I would love to kind of try to unpack that.
Yeah, that's excellent. Some other topics you mentioned we might cover is the painter Bruegel and his Fall of Icarus.
Oh, endlessly fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, if we do that, we'll throw up a slide on the website. Yes, it's almost like it reminds me of kind of a Hidden Pictures that you might find like a kid's magazine.
Right.
Like, where's Icarus? You look at that painting. If you just walk by it, it's called The Fall of Icarus, but if you stop to look, where's Icarus?
Mm-hmm.
And all you see are kind of his kicking legs in the bottom corner.
Coming up out of the ocean.
Right.
Everyone's going about their business, and yet there is poor Icarus who has plummeted to his death, as Ovid describes in the Metamorphoses, because he flew too close to the sun.
But at a glance, it would seem that painting has nothing to do with Icarus, but it starts fascinating once you start peeling the layers. I forget the date of that painting. I want to say 17th century.
It's Dutch master, if I'm not mistaken.
1600s. But exploring kind of what is Bruegel doing with the myth, and why is he taking Icarus off center stage?
Right.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about Aristophanes.
Oh, yes.
The great Greek comedian.
Of whom both of us are big fans.
Big fans.
Yes.
Aristophanes and how he relates to the Marx brothers.
Yes.
So Aristophanes, as the scholar H.J. Rose says, is the ancient author who is at the same time the most scandalous or dirty. A lot of his jokes are vituperative jokes, making fun of people, scatological jokes. That means bathroom humor.
Yes.
You can't really get through Aristophanes without being exposed to a lot of, I don't know, pretty scandalous language.
He would be immediately canceled.
Definitely.
Today.
Definitely.
Yes.
And at the same time, Rose says he is the greatest advocate of traditional morality.
Yes.
So Aristophanes was an arch conservative in Athenian culture. He had no time for democracy. He had no time for those who didn't have property. He'd be canceled for those things as well.
That's right.
And yet the really fascinating thing about Aristophanes, I would say, agree with him or not, is that he combines these two elements. Very low brow humor with very old-fashioned and traditional principles.
Right.
And we see that in some of the Marx Brothers movies.
Absolutely, right. And just kind of that mix of high commentary with absurdism.
Yeah.
Right?
Vicious political satire.
Yes.
But with utterly ridiculous and silly episodes.
And that is a mix I think that is almost impossible to pull off, right? I would make the argument that comedy has never been freer than it was in the hands of Aristophanes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mythic archetypes and the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yes.
This is one for you, Jeff. What can you say
about
that?
This for me, I would say that you're kind of the bigger Marvel fan than I am.
I have seen all the movies, I have to confess, but I have three teenage children, so.
All I know is that when a movie comes out, it's usually you who texts me first about going to see
said film. That's a good point. You're gonna pin Aquaman on me too, right?
I'm blaming you for Aquaman. I've read things along the lines that, you know, the comic book superheroes are basically just kind of American repackagings of Greek mythological.
So
heroes.
Iron Man is...
I would say he's very much a Hephaestus to me.
Vulcan among the Romans.
Vulcan, the god of craftsmanship, of metallurgy.
Yep.
Right. The forge.
Self-made man, kind of.
The self-made man, right.
There's that scene in one of the Iron Man movies, I don't remember which, his origin story, it's probably the first one, he's in the cave, he has to fashion all of these elements.
Just out of what's around him.
That's That's right.
Right.
Very similar to Hephaestus.
Yes, exactly. Although Robert Downey Jr., Hephaestus is famous for being ugly and dragging a lame leg around.
That's right.
And Robert Downey Jr. is more of a
Hollywood type.
Hollywood kind of a pinup.
Like the hosts of the podcast, basically, we would have to say.
Exactly right.
So in addition to mythic archetypes the Marvel classical universe.
These are all kind of in my wheelhouse. You want to mention some of the things that you want to talk about?
Right. So we said that when I was in graduate school, fascinated with Plato.
Yes.
Fascinated with Cicero. Those obsessions continue. One of the most, this is a little heavier maybe, but hopefully we have a broad audience. One of the most interesting elements about Plato is which of his dialogues had the longest shelf life. So you might be surprised to learn that the Timaeus, one of the later dialogues.
One of the last, right?
Yes, one of the last. I think only the Laws, Hoi Nomoi, is later than the Timaeus. The Timaeus was endlessly fascinating to the church fathers and on into the Renaissance. And that's because it deals with questions of creation, metaphysics, ontology, you know, all these big, heavy jaw-breaking words about how did everything come into existence.
Right.
And Plato has a persuasive, a compelling, a coherent argument for how the world was created. There's a demiurge that mixes together things like sameness and difference, identity, and so forth. And this dialogue, which is not really a Platonic dialogue because Socrates indulges in these long monologues, this Timaeus was really significant long term.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. I also want to talk about places we've visited, either individually or together.
Yeah.
So we had the opportunity, I think, again, it was 2016, to go down the coast of Italy. We took the train from Rome down to Formiae, which is the halfway point between Rome and Pompeii.
Yeah, more
Rome
or less.
And Naples. And we saw there the tomb, the supposed tomb of Cicero.
Cicero, right.
Yep. It's just kind of off the beaten path, not far from the Via Appia.
Right.
A spot of the road, which is still exposed. Of course, St. Paul walked the Via Appia from Puteoli up to Rome.
That's right.
And so there at Formiae, we're going to talk about the tomb of Cicero.
And Formiae was also where Cicero had one of his villas, and the villa that he kind of made this half-hearted attempt to escape when,
that's right,
when his neck was on the line. And
the henchmen of Mark Antony hunted him down.
Hunted him down, and he died in or near Formiae.
That's right. December 7, a day that will live in infamy.
That's right.
December 7, 43 BC. That's when of course, after that, Augustus had remorse, apparently, because he had sold out Cicero in order to win over the support of his arch rival.
It was right about brutal compromise
that
he had to make.
All of the conscriptions. Cicero's name was at the top of the list.
That's right.
So I want to also talk about the Renaissance.
Yes.
This has been an emerging area of interest for me. I got into classics backwards through theologians and so forth of the 16th century, men like John Calvin, Theodore Bayes. I got into classics backwards and then have come back to the Renaissance and the Reformation. So we want to talk about some of those topics as well.
Right.
It's really a broad range of interest, a smorgasbord, you might say.
Yes.
Of topics.
Yes, exactly. And like we said at the beginning, we'll jump around all the time, but we're dipping in and out of 4,000 years of human history and culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how can our listeners get involved, Jeff?
Well, they can obviously be faithful listeners
to
the podcast. Check the app for new episodes. You can log on to our webpage.
What is that webpage?
That is audnasium.com, but not with a U, but with the Roman
Maybe we V. Better spell it out.
Yes, it would be A-D-N-A-V. S-E-A-M.
And what's that V doing in there?
Well, that's with the
Could it be that we don't know how to spell Latin?
Well, no, that's not the case. It's just that the Romans didn't have a... well, actually, it was because Aud Nauseam with a U was taken.
That particular website was spoken for?
Spoken for, right.
Yeah, I think as I researched it, it would take almost six figures to purchase that.
Is that right? Wow.
So we decided that was not the way to go.
Yeah. Well, once we start making six figures ourselves, maybe we can do a hostile takeover.
That's right. So it's A-D-N-A-V...
Yes.
S-E-A-M.
.com. So there you'll find information about us, about the podcast, extra things like the Latin passage that David was quoting from.
Things we like to read.
Things we like to read.
Translations we would recommend.
Images, pictures, paintings that we may refer to. I see it as a great thing to maybe have even open on your device as you listen to us.
What if listeners want to send in suggestions for topics? Because it could be that the things that interest us, I know it's hard to believe, Jeff, the things that interest us don't interest other people.
Yeah, I don't see how that could be.
Not
But if somebody wanted us to talk about a particular topic, shoot us an email at topics@adnauseum.com. Again, nauseum with a V.
Right.
Yes.
So as we wrap up, we want to say thank you to all those who have tuned in for this inaugural episode.
Yes, many thanks.
Yeah, we ourselves are learning, so we're going to smooth out some things, and we look forward to having you as guests. Are we also going to have guests other than the two of us, Jeff?
That is the plan.
Okay.
If we can convince people, or maybe trick people,
right,
to come in and talk with us, we're going to have to get a third mic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do we have some contacts, as another leading question? Do we have some contacts in the world of classics?
We do. It's a small family.
It is.
Right. We know, between the two of us, we know a number of people.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get sick of hearing us,
that's
jabber
right.
on.
Experts in Virgil, experts in Apollonius of Rhodes, experts in John Calvin in the 16th century, experts in Erasmus, all kinds of things.
Yes, exactly.
Do we hope to pick up a spew listeners along the way?
Spew?
A spew listeners to ad nauseam?
Just a spew.
Okay.
As we go, yes. But to wrap it up then, thank you everyone for listening. Check out the website for upcoming episodes and upcoming topics. As the ancient Romans themselves, as Julius Caesar himself,
I think it was Julius,
often said, bon appetit.